Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest Nostalgia interview to meet Cameron Tucker.
Hello, Chris.
Great to have you on. And of course, you were my first guest on the Kent Film Club, but you're also very senior, of course, in the world of KMTV.
First guest on the Kent Film Club and several guests down the line from when I said I'd be a guest on this. It's been a long time in the making, but I'm very happy to finally come on and chat with you.
Well, was it Vanessa Williams who said save the best till last?
Well, hopefully not the last. Hopefully you've got a fair few more to go. KMTV, I mean, that's how we met. That's how this working relationship, this friendship began all those years ago.
Yeah, and it's been incredible. So anyone listening will probably already be familiar with my multiple posts on social media about the latest interview I've done, or where I've been interviewed or done the film programme. And it's been remarkable because we met when we were doing Generation Y, a TV series that we started in 2022, took us around the country. Obviously, you were significantly involved in that. You also drove everyone, as well as being the senior producer.
KMTV chauffeur, yes.
You were. I don't think there were many counties in England that we didn't actually reach.
I think in England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, all four nations that we went to, and that was obviously a big part of how we got the series that we were going to cover and make sure 11 to 15 year olds in all four nations were represented across age, gender, sexual orientation, you know, all the gamut of voices that were covered. And that was an amazing opportunity to go to all of those corners of the UK just to talk about people's views about faith and spirituality, and in so many ways that I didn't know that we would go down those avenues. I'm not sure if there were avenues you expected to go down.
No, what I felt is that as somebody who's been working in higher education for decades, it was such a relief not to be the person who had to say, this is what pagans do, this is what Jews do, Muslims do, Christians do. What was lovely is to say, here's an 11-year-old who's a practicing ... maybe a witch, maybe a Jew, maybe a Muslim, and for them to tell us what faith mattered to them. So I was learning. So the educator who was being educated by the 11-year-olds, who were so articulate, who were so passionate, and able to do things that I couldn't have done at their age, which was effectively to go on TV and show to the world their collection of artifacts to show why their faith was so important to them, to go on location to their places of worship. So it was actually, I think for me, a really transitional experience, because it showed that there was a life beyond me standing in front of, if I'm honest, sometimes a diminishing number of students who might want to study at university, just to realise that there's a world out there that I needed to tap into.
I don't know if it's a particularly British thing, if it's a particularly generational thing, but I definitely felt going into the series, and I had a little bit of this, but definitely older generations might fear asking particular questions, especially to young people, or just kind of assuming young people don't have these opinions. They'll just doom scroll on TikTok or Instagram or whatever it is, and not have those really, those thoughts about their place in the world and belief systems, and have that aspect of critical thinking. And the series just completely debunked that. It showed a whole plethora of people, like we were talking about just now, who are really open to having candid conversations about themselves, their communities, their traditions, and answering them in a really thoughtful, profound way. And so I think it was a really encouraging project. I think it said, you know, we always talk about hope for the youth, and this really was a demonstration of that.
And I also found that in doing that, it just showed that the sort of template that was once available to us, the textbook effectively, was something that I needed in my profession in higher education. And I used to work from that. And I'd often say, you know, each year to the students, this is the way we'll begin to know about the world religions, etc. But by the end of it, I thought that I was learning far more from meeting practitioners in their communities and doing that through the medium of television.
And just asking as well, just asking questions. I think we really lose sight of that, because everything is so readily available now. And I'm guilty of it, where I'll just look online, I'll get the answers to what I want. But, you know, I still remember those days of having to look through a book, having to really scour through documents to find answers to what you want, or just to call up people and ask them questions. And I feel that's going, but the series was a good way of rekindling that. And they are really important skills. You know, it's important to ask people about the world, to find out about the world, to know how to converse with one another. And yeah, just to play a small part of that was a joy.
Yeah, I remember being at school in the 80s, in very early 90s, when there was an expectation then that somehow, you know, if you wanted to know the answer to something, ask your teacher. If the teacher gave you a handout, then that you know, you'd imagine, perhaps naively, that would be the passport to get through your exams. You know, get through your GCSEs because the teacher has given you the answers, and you know, you'd see them in the way as the ultimate arbiters.
On a pedestal. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then you go to university, and then you have the people who write the books on these topics, and they're the professionals, they're the experts. But they're really saying, go to the library and look at these many books and formulate your own answers. And you're thinking, hang on a minute, I thought you were going to tell us the answer to the question so we can pass our exams. Mm. I mean, if I did ever think that was certainly debunked very early on. And I had the best university experience because I realised that I was allowed to write on things that may not have been what the person teaching thought, but I was coming to that view independently because, you said, that in those days we didn't really have the internet. I mean, I suppose by the time I'd finished my undergraduate, I graduated in 94, there was this thing called the World Wide Web. I think it was another year or two before I properly tapped into that. But it was almost a sort of... not naive, but it was by today's standards, this world where you go into a library, take some books, maybe a few dusty books off the shelves, read through them, and then suddenly feel, having done proper research, that you were an expert. It almost feels, from the point of view of today, where, as you say, information is very much at our fingertips, that was the way to know the answer to something.
Yeah, I mean, on that, there's a great moment in, I think it's in the first episode of Generation Y, where Sadgan, your co-presenter, was moderating a panel in Manchester, and he's talking to students in the school, and they were talking about the dangers of social media and how information can be misinterpreted, especially in relation to faith and religion and spirituality. And one of the kids from Manchester said to Sadgan, if I wanted to find out about Hinduism, which Sadgan practices, I would come to you for... you know, if I have questions and I wanted answers, rather than relying on what I'd see online. And I think that was so, it was like, yes, that's the key. It's asking people who have had that lived experience, and having that, you know, that inquisitive nature as well. For me personally, I've always had that. I think I grew up with that from my mum and from my grandparents. It was always like that. When I'd come over and see them in the holidays, they'd always take me to historical sites, or, you know, we'd go to museums, and you know, the stuff that I would read just really kind of gave me that, you know, sense of there's a bigger world than just this kind of little pond that I'm in, and to look beyond and to connect with all of that is so important.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, because I know that I was about to say your birth narrative, but it almost is, because you do have a far more exotic origin story, shall we say, than many people, including myself. I mean, I may have been born in a different country, but that other country was Wales. So, you know, in your case...
It's the other side, yeah, of the seven. It is a whole other country.
But also, just before going down that path... That's the curious thing, isn't it? Because we live in a world now that is both bigger and smaller. Mm. That you can sit in your room and tap into the internet, maybe converse with people literally the other side of the world. But that doesn't mean to say that we are necessarily more enlightened, that we've evolved, you know, in a way that people still have petty or small. You know, we all think in ways sometimes that are within particular boxes, that in a way that the more access we have to, for example, the internet, the more closed or more narrow, because obviously we can't read and we can't know everything. So that there's that sort of paradox. I feel that I was there, and maybe it was more that in those days you'd go to an office or you go to a library to get documents. Maybe it was an electoral register, or you'd want to find out your family history. When it's at the click of a finger, it sometimes feels easier, but in those days it felt like more rewarding because of the effort we had to put into it.
It's quite clinical now. And I think, you know, again, talking about my kind of upbringing, I've always had this massive love of travel, this proper wanderlust, and I spend quite, you know, my sort of Rome, I guess, is looking at different routes and different journeys that I could go on and looking at the map and seeing how I could get from A to B, especially like really grand journeys. And you look at the world now, and to get from, say, one side of Europe to the other, or to get to Asia, for example, there's so many barriers now. You look at what's going on in Russia and Ukraine, and now you look at to the south and things are going on in the Middle East. And so you say that we're all and we are far more connected than we've ever been, and that's just going to continue. But in some ways, the world is getting more and more insular as well, and getting to a time that you might remember more of towards the kind of latter end of the Cold War, and how there were vast swathes of the world that were just cordoned off and that you'd hear very, very little about. So whether or not that's just a new iteration of that is what's happening now, or if it is just really, really closing up, I don't know. But I think it's only a good thing to have connections everywhere and to find out what is going on in all those far-flung places.
Because I'd love to know how the journey started, because am I right in thinking you were born, was it in Hong Kong?
No, so I grew up in Hong Kong. I was actually born in the States. So my mum and my dad met on Camp America. My mum was at Swansea University. She went over to Camp America during a summer, I think. Met my dad on that. They eventually got married. I was born in Manhattan and grew up in the States for a couple of years. And my parents split up and moved to Hong Kong because my mum had grown up in Hong Kong. My grandparents had moved out in the 60s. Granddad was a policeman. My gran had a few jobs, including she worked for BA at one point in Hong Kong as well. And they were there in that period of kind of colonial heyday of the 60s all the way through to 97 when Hong Kong was handed back to China. And my mum was born in 1969, my uncle was born in 1970. And so so my mum experienced Hong Kong growing up, came to the UK for university, then lived in the States, and then came back to Hong Kong. So she's British, but has spent practically all of her life in Hong Kong.
And in terms of your own identity, I'm guessing that you have dual passports, and you have a very fascinating, almost hybrid.
I do. So I've got a British passport from my mum's side, American passport from my dad's side, and a permanent residency in Hong Kong as well, which I really wear all of those with pride. And COVID was one of those times that really kind of got you thinking about your identity and your place in the world, and not being able to go to those places as well. And there's interesting rules around, which I won't go into too much, but if you don't go to Hong Kong in a certain amount of time, then your residency lapses. I was really worried that would happen. And even though it didn't really mean a lot, I could still travel to Hong Kong. And I think it only really meant I wouldn't be able to get property in Hong Kong, which anybody who knows Hong Kong property prices is not going to be an issue, because I'm never going to get to that threshold. But it was more kind of symbolically, I felt that was part of me that I was losing. And fortunately, I went back a couple of times earlier this year, and that wasn't the case. I've still got the permanent residency. But I'm very proud of having grown up there, and having, being British and being American as well. That obviously changes with sports. I have different.
Well, you're wearing a Hong Kong rugby t-shirt.
I am indeed. I've gone very on the nose with that for the Nostalgia podcast. So, I have different affiliations. I think especially when, people ask you, "Oh, are you supporting the football?" It's always got to be England for my sins. But anytime you see Hong Kong in the Olympics, for example, I absolutely love sports. And this year in the Olympics, Hong Kong had a particularly good year, and that was really nice to follow, especially as one of the gold medalists for Hong Kong was in the year below me at school, the school that I was at in Hong Kong. So, anytime you see Hong Kong, it's like a nice little flashback to the 16, 17 years that I was there.
And do you have any records? I mean, I've always kept diaries, but do you have anything? I assume you have lots of photographs, because there would have been it would have been a digital age, at least, because when I was your age, we had old-fashioned photographs we'd have to take to Boots the chemist, and in some cases have to wait days before they'd be
the little Kodak released.
And hope that we didn't do, which I did a few times, which is to maybe not wind the film on properly. So there are missing terms from my university days, which is tragic. But in your case, do you have records from that period that you have access to?
Yeah, I've got my gran to thank for that. Sadly, she passed away earlier this year, but she has always been a photo junkie, and almost to an embarrassing effect, we'd be out for meals, and she'd like pull a waitress aside and be like, "Oh, can you get a photo?" I'm sure everyone has that in their families, but now it's like, I'm so grateful that that she did that, because there is that collection, not just from my early days, but from their early days in Hong Kong as well, which is just looking at it and the area they lived in first when they came to Hong Kong was right on the border with China, now heavily built up, back then basically rice paddies and water buffalo wandering through, and just being able to have that documented is amazing, and I'm definitely now channeling that myself. Got a newborn son, and I've got that embarrassing dad/older relative of making sure that we get photos of everything, and plenty of blackmail for them in years to come with certain outfits that we put them in as well.
Well, I also think that I learnt the phrase the other day of self-blackmail, which is if you put all these really awful pictures of or videos of oneself out there, then actually nobody can really blackmail you, because you say no. Stuff is there, and I put it there.
Transparency is key.
It is. But so, and congratulations. So you have a seven-week-old son.
Seven-week-old, still. So my fiancé Stevie and I were still, still functional at this point on nice 4-hour blocks of sleep, which is, I'm told, part and parcel of the experience. But little Alistair, he's 7 weeks old, doing amazingly well, going through, there's a lot of appointments when found out that when you have a kid, but in between that, it's just enjoying the experience and showing them off to all who'll see and listen.
Yeah, and I had the great privilege of meeting your fiancé and also Alistair last Thursday. So that was amazing, and congratulations, because I know that when you look back, sometimes I think, how does one manage with a newborn, when you mention all the sleep deprivation? And I do have a confession, because I know we're both into films, but sometimes when one of my daughters would come down, and I'd be sitting on the settee thinking, this is my moment, after a busy evening looking after the children, and one of my daughters wouldn't sleep, and in fact, she would do everything she could to get out of her cot. And so in the end, you think, just come downstairs. And sometimes I think, well, she's falling asleep on the couch, right? So I'll watch the films now that I couldn't possibly watch earlier. One of them was Inglourious. I won't say the next word, but it was the Quentin Tarantino film. The other one was Serial, one with Kathleen Turner. Both of them have some interesting sort of moments of violence, shall we say. And then I thought, right, my daughter's asleep. So I thought, I'll watch these films now and, do my reviews, whatever I was doing. I was happily thinking, this is a moment to myself. Looked over, and my daughter bolted awake. She was staring, watching the screen, and I was thinking, this actually is not, there's a reason why films have ratings,
years of therapy later.
my 2-month-old is watching a Quentin Tarantino. No, and I do honestly think I mentioned this to her recently, and she has some vague recollection of remembering this. I was thinking, well, I shouldn't be admitting this, but make the most of it. And I also think you'll find your own pathway through, because we talked about manuals and textbooks earlier, but actually when it comes to the children, I have more than one, and they're all totally different. What worked with one wasn't an issue with the other. Some of them slept beautifully all night. Others would never get to sleep. But what worked with one didn't work with the other. And then, of course, you, when you have more than one child, they all play off each other anyway. And then they're all competing with each other. So you're thinking, I could not have possibly imagined any of these scenarios that are playing out before me.
And there's so much what Stevie and I found out through the pregnancy phase and the various classes that we went to and things that we read and found out about from, you know, anecdotal experience from other parents. There's so much of it is instinctual as well, and listening to your gut and listening to what baby might need is such a key part of it. I think it seems to me it's often overlooked because of what somebody has written in a textbook, you know, 20, 30 years ago and has now become part of the norm. And just being kind of, just not shutting off those kind of instincts is really key. And what we're finding, I'm sure it'll be further down the line when we get to terrible twos and threenagers, it will be pouring through the books again to be like, how do we deal with this?
But what you will also find, and admittedly I'm not there with my own children, but when Alistair is older, he might think, what a fascinating thing. American, you know, father born in America, grew up in Hong Kong. So my own parents have my mum certainly has followed the footsteps of her own parents who grew up in Worcestershire, and that they now live in the part of the world where they descended from. And I mean, my own children, as I say, are not at that stage because, you know, they don't read anything I write or watch anything I do or listen to anything I do on the radio. So I'm sort of hoping that one day they'll think, oh, this is an interesting, you know, eccentric life that my father led. But that's the exciting bit. There's always, you're effectively laying down for them a kind of, maybe not blueprint, but something that might be of use in a very bespoke way to them. You know, it may be many years in the future.
Yeah, and I think there's obviously values that we both want to instill in him, but I am also really, almost fixated on that he will have, he will have interesting tales to tell and will be able to say that I, you know, grew up and had this experience or... we did this at this time, this time, and so I definitely want to have that available because it was an amazing thing for me in that I got to experience that, and I want him to have that same experience. It's not going to be the same as mine, but I want that same feeling that I had for him.
Yeah, and do you find that when you look back on growing up in Hong Kong, because obviously you've been with KMTV for 7 years, do you sort of look back and think, did that really happen? Because it must be, in some ways, you must sort of have flashbacks sometimes to things that no one else around you here has experienced. Because at least I've got friends. Admittedly, I'm from Cardiff, so maybe I don't have that many around me in Kent. But, you know, there are people I can tap into. We have these sort of shared experiences. But you have a very different cultural experience.
It's a very different cultural experience, but it's also... It comes back to that point that we're saying about connectedness. All of the friends and the family friends that I was really near and dear to, I'm still near and dear to, and a lot of them aren't in Hong Kong anymore. But a lot of them are in the UK. There's some in Australia. There's some in the States. My best mate is here in the UK as well. So we can obviously revisit some of those experiences. But it's also, you kind of grow up with that in Hong Kong. It's a very transient place. I've had a lot of friends who came and went at different times for various reasons, for schooling, as parents, jobs. It's quite a nomadic existence like that. So I've always kind of been aware of that, and so that's not, it's not like, I guess, a sort of a Proustian sort of flashbacks of, things that happened in my youth. I think about it and I meet people, like I said, from my youth quite a lot, and friends, but it's not like I feel completely disassociated from it now.
And also, that said, I find that, because I do radio in Herne Bay, but often a lot of my listeners or those who get in touch are people who know me and are, for example, in Dubai or in France or, you know, in literally America. And they're the ones who often, because of the distance, have one in Australia, for example, who regularly gets in touch. And I think that's the thing is about connection, because they think, okay, they may have once had an association with Kent or certainly the UK and with me. And that's, you know, they may be the other side of the world, but the connection is all the more important than, you know, because if you're just down the road, you think, well, I can listen next week or it doesn't really matter. But it's like in the days in the 90s when I would go and buy videos from shops, it was almost that you want to do something, it's a bit harder to do, so it's all the more special. You make the effort, because you know that this is precious, you don't want to leave it another week. Whereas sometimes, if you live somewhere and there's a big castle nearby, like I did in Cardiff, you think, well, I'd go anytime, so you never go. So it's almost as though the distance actually makes you all the more ready to do things in a more kind of now way.
Yeah, and also when you're back in those places that you know you will do stuff, it's, you know, I was back there in April for my best mate's weddings, and it was just continuing where I'd left off with everybody. And we didn't really have many set plans. We obviously had the wedding was a set plan. But other than that, there wasn't really any set plans for the week or so when we were out there. But just organically, it's a very Hong Kong thing where people just go out. Everyone just kind of gravitates towards places, people, and you just end up doing the, you know, whatever experiences they are. You don't really go out with a particular checklist. And that's kind of always been the case with my Hong Kong friends, from friends in other countries where I've been, uni mates. It's always just continuing where you left off, and it's a really nice feeling that I have.
Yeah, and you would have been there during the handover, of course. Or you would have been too young to remember it in 97.
Yes. So my granddad was a policeman, like I said, and he retired in 97. I can't talk to any of the feelings that there might have been around then for people in Hong Kong of what the future would have held. But from my own experience, the Hong Kong that I remember from when I was really, really small to now is completely different. I mean, obviously there's a whole political discussion, around that, but just visually, the change. Every time, you know, we always joke that anytime we go back, there's a whole new apartment complex down the road, or there's a whole new shopping mall where they used to be. It's just a constantly evolving place.
And also, that's the thing about nostalgia. I found that with the place I went to university, which is very different in many ways. And in fact, it doesn't exist in the same way that it did, certainly in terms of the students. The campus is still there, but it doesn't offer anything that it did 30 years ago. And
including the drink prices as well. They'll have shut up considerably.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because do you find that you're nostalgic then are you doing what my parents, grandparents did, which is to always say, oh, it used to be better in my day.
Back in my day, yeah. That's definitely creeped in the last few years. So I don't know if that's just a natural thing, if that's an old soul or old before my time kind of thing, but yeah, 100% there's definitely those elements that are creeping in.
And that's the thing about nostalgia, but we'll come on to that in this chat as well, because you might pine for something that happened, something that's passed, but it doesn't actually always mean that you have to resist change. I mean, the podcast didn't exist in the 90s, and we wrote letters in the 90s, and we had VHS tapes and audio cassettes. I'm not pining for those in themselves, but they did the job then that other forms of technology are doing now, and they served their purpose. But often they need to be digitized. So in a way, it's sort of making the most of what you can in the age, but also being able then to allow those artifacts, those whatever it might be, it may be literal records, maybe vinyl from those days, and bringing them up to date, but in a way that allows you to embrace the future as much as it is to cling on to a past that in many cases defines who you are.
I think it's, I often find with looking at older pictures or older artifacts, like you said, it's just really, it's a really helpful exercise in reflection as well, to show either how far the world's progressed, how far progressed in oneself, or how far friends and family have progressed as well. And it's not done often, and especially I feel in the industry that I work in the creative industries, it's always, what's the next thing we're going to make? How are we going to create the next innovative film, radio, podcast, whatever it is? There's not, and I don't think you should like dwell in it and stew in it, but I think it's important to every now and then go back and be like, I was there, I'm now here, we were here collectively at this point, we've now got to this stage. And especially in, you know, I imagine the world that we're in as well at the moment, it's a very difficult place. It's also important to remember what we do have in this world that we didn't have a year, 5 years, a decade ago. And I think those little exercises are really helpful just to keep one sane, really.
Because there is that danger that we all do it of consolidating the past, that the composite, like, oh, those were happy days. What you're thinking is all the good things you almost imagine happening at once. And you, but in reality, there may have been pockets of good days, but that's why I enjoy keeping a diary, because it's a good corrective against that grass is always greener sort of scenario, because you realise, well, yeah, there were some good moments, but they were interspersed, as they do today and in any age, with things that we might not be so fond of looking back.
Yeah, but it's still important to remember all of that. The whole holistic picture is key to that.
And I've got to ask you, because we touched on films earlier, and well, because I know your all-time favourite films, because you've, or at least certain the ones that have made the impression over the years was from Kent Film Club. But what about music? Did that play a big role for you growing up?
Yeah, I was thinking about this on the way in, actually, because, you know, one of the films that we spoke about was Good Will Hunting, and I think another reason that really sticks is I remember that the soundtrack for that film, my mum would always play, or was one of the CDs, remember those? One of the CDs that mum played in the morning getting ready for work. So, yeah, it's not, I don't think music was necessarily like, you know, you hear some people on Desert Island Discs, for example, that say that the gramophone was on all the time, and that it wasn't that kind of experience, but I always did get affected by music and had a good eclectic range as well from family and friend influences, from film and TV. I think probably most of the music I listened to is I would have heard on the box or the screen in some shape or form, and that's something that definitely Stevie and I are really conscious of for Alistair. We want to have that music, that culture, imbued from a really, really early stage. So whether it is playing music in the house, whether it is watching telly, whether it is taking him to places, we fully embrace the suburban, middle class, new parent cliche and got a National Trust membership. And so taking him to those sorts of things. So all of that, you know, I had a very, very culturally rich upbringing, and that's something that we're really keen to pass on to the little man.
Yeah. And of course you work in TV, but how did you end up here in Kent? Because I know you went to university in Norwich, is that right?
Yes.
East Anglia?
Yeah, so I'd always wanted to do something in the creative, something storytelling based. So my first ever bit of experience was working as a junior reporter for South China Morning Post, which is the only English language, or it's one of the only English language papers in Hong Kong. So I did that the summer before I came to uni, which was back in 2011. I went to University of East Anglia for 3 years, Did lots of work experience there, and any kind of elective modules that I could do in journalism or broadcast journalism, I did. Did a bit of work experience at The Independent over that time as well. And then graduated in 2014, went to the University of Sheffield to do a broadcast journalism master's. And, you know, that was a year, quite a hard nosed year, hard graft year rather, of knuckling down and, you know, finessing and polishing the actual nuts and bolts of the industry and the craft. And then had about an 18-month period, which, you know, we come to this reflection, we're talking about this reflection point, that I had some incredible experiences of freelancing. So I did, went back to Hong Kong, worked for the only English language radio station out there for a time, doing sports reporting, went to Sri Lanka to do a radio DJ apprenticeship, did some sports reporting in South Korea, came back to the UK and did some local radio in Dorset, where my grandparents live. I did, worked for a TV production house in London for a bit as well. So I got all these incredible bits of experience, but it was also really hard because it was the freelance life and it was all those cliches of, you know, hand-to-mouth existence, feast, famine, all of that, all of those, you know, sayings come to mind. And then this job came up, did a horrendous interview, but I'm told did a very good screen test, and I know I had a really good show reel, and that's apparently what did it. With the backing of the channel director, Andy Richards, who's still in that position now, who I'm forever grateful for giving me that. And yeah, 7 years down the line, you know, I'm still here, but like I said, all the experiences I've got in the job, but also my first role was as a patch reporter in West Kent. So lived in a house share in Tunbridge Wells, which is where I met Stevie, because she moved into the house share. And then a month later, we were going out, and wow. Six and a bit years later, here we are with a child in a house and all that goes with it.
It's lovely, isn't it, when you can look back and you know, in a way it feels inevitable, or it's the right thing, or serendipity, all those sort of things. But yeah, considering you know, all the places you've lived in the world, you know, you ended up, you know, it's all worked out very well for you. But you could never, if anybody had said to you in your Hong Kong days, this is where you'll be living and what you'll be doing professionally, or who you'll be marrying, or whatever, you probably would have thought, how can that be?
I'd never been to Kent before I had the job. I think I did, was in Kent once. There was, I don't know if they had this in your day, you had Jailbreak, which was, it was all for the Raising and Giving Society, and you'd raise a bunch of money, and there'd be a competition where you'd be in a group, and you had to get from as far away from the uni as possible in a 48-hour period. And mate and I got to Paris eventually, but we stopped very briefly in Ashford to hitch a lift with one of his dad's friends' lorry companies and got over the border that way. And so that was my only time that I'd been in Kent prior to getting the job.
Yeah, so similar for me, I suppose, in the sense that I lived in Wales for the first 31 years of my life, and now I've spent the last 20 here in Canterbury. But again, couldn't, you know, in a way there's a randomness to it, but it's not entirely random, because, you know, there's a reason why one moves, and it's because of what one did previously, that you have qualifications for a certain job, and then a job comes up in that place. It's not like you randomly put a, you know, put a dot on the map.
Yeah, it's not quite, Gromit laying down the rail track as the train comes. It's not quite like that, though it certainly, I think, definitely feels it at times.
Yeah, and I've got to ask as well, in the sense, because there was a very famous, in fact, it's often talked about, it was even talked about on Kentonite recently, when you were on location doing a report, and you made it all the way into, was it the Jimmy Kimmel show?
It was, yeah. It's definitely got its mileage, that video. So this was back in 2018. So it was about a year. I'd been at KMTV for about a year. Was told to go and do this live about a drugs bust just on the outskirts of Canterbury. I actually didn't want to go and do the piece. I was editing something else. And I rather reluctantly traipsed to Canterbury to do the report. And about just as I started, almost perfect comic timing, talking about how this small cottage in the outskirts of the Kentish countryside had been found to be harbouring tons of marijuana plants. I looked over my shoulder and somebody was running with a very suspicious looking plant. It wasn't a weed plant, but it was very, you know, this guy's comic timing, credit to him, because obviously the video has gone viral. It's given a lot of people a lot of joy. And it just blew up from there. Still don't know who the person is to this day. They did send me a Christmas card that year, so it feels a little bit sort of, you know, a nice version of Zodiac, I guess, with getting those messages. But it's given it's given a lot of people a lot of joy. It gets brought up very regularly, and I know that my journalism career peaked in 2018.
And do you think, I mean, in a way, I use the word serendipity, but because I have spoken to you about this before, and I know that it really happened. I've watched it, but do you think that as you say, it almost, you couldn't have made it up, that it wasn't just that he was there. He was there when you were filming that piece, and it was almost as though the camera was in the right place. Do you think that this was all, he knew what was going on?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, we've been set up there for about an hour before we go. Like, I mean, this is the thing with TV, is there's so much that goes into moments that, you know, obviously not that was completely natural, but we were there for an hour. I'd done two rehearsals up to that point. I was the intern that I'd gone with, so I was driving, he was giving me the notes, so I was going through all that I was going to say on the drive there. But you can't write that, you know, that was, but he'd obviously was living in the area, seen what happened, thought, I know what I'm going to do. And credit to him, he wrote something better than any comedy writer could have written.
Totally. Do you, and anybody now listening to this, of course, we'll look up Cameron Tucker. What would it be? The KMTV drugs story,
be like,
of 2018,
Pop Man, or something along those lines.
Now, I'd love to know what was going through your head, because did you think, first of all, oh, this person is ruining my piece to camera, we'll have to do it again? Or did you immediately think, hang on a minute, this is the best news story?
No, it was, well, so it was live.
I didn't realise it was live.
So it was a live report. So it was at the top of the second part of the show, which was great, because, again, it's timing and everything. If we'd been at the top of part A or further on in the show, it might not have happened. But anyway, it was the top of the second part, and I was already, as you know, I was quite grumpy because I didn't really want to go out and do this piece. I was struggling with some of the details. And it's always with legal stories, you've got to make sure that you're getting the terminology right. So that was going through my head as well. And that happened. So as I turned, as you see in the video, as I turned, he ran past. I kind of was just like, right, keep a straight face, keep going, but this is really annoying, this has disrupted my life. And then I actually, that was kind of an afterthought, because also what happened in that was we'd had a big old lorry go, because it's near the M20, everyone going to and from the channel. So there's a big old lorry that I couldn't hear the gallery at one point when it went past, so I was trying to not lose my train of thought. A biplane went over as well, so there are all these distractions going on. So I kind of actually, it was a bit of an afterthought, the guy running past. And then, later that evening, it definitely came to the forefront.
And did you, was anybody like talking in your ear when this was happening? So were you aware at the time that this really was something quite big? But rather, because if it had been me, part of me would think, oh no, you know, this is live TV and it's all being too distracted. But also I do live radio, and if somebody walks into the studio, we've had to have people almost accidentally walk into the studio, and you make it part of the show, and it's a better for it because it's that level of spontaneity. Yeah. But this is something that you couldn't, there's no way in your wildest dreams you would have imagined this happening when you were doing that piece.
No, and it was really early on in my... I hadn't done TV really up until this job, so I was still learning the craft at that point, and spontaneity is key in it. We had a really good producer who, there was some people in the gallery who were giggling, and which I could hear, and he was like, right, quiet, please. So he was up. So that helped me get through the rest of that that live, and then it all just kind of took on a life of its own when it got uploaded later on that evening.
Because there is another Cameron Tucker, isn't there, in America?
There is, yeah. Yes. Of Modern Family fame, with great series, my favourite comedy series. But we are very, very unlike, the two of us. He's a great character, and to be a namesake is of that caliber is great.
But the question is, which of the Cameron Tuckers has had more YouTube hits? I think following the pop man, and hopefully through this interview now, Cameron, the numbers will shoot up.
The original, the OG. The original,
yeah. All right. As we start to wrap up, just some sort of questions really about reflections on the past. Would you consider... I mean, I suppose it's sort of a question really about what nostalgia is. We've hinted at this already. But, you know, can you be nostalgic about negative experiences? Can you be nostalgic about something that maybe even at the time you knew wasn't entirely okay, but you look back and think, yeah, it may be a stronger person?
That's a really good question. I've never heard that that before. I think it depends how you use it, doesn't it? If I was listening to an interview yesterday with the actor Jeffrey Wright, American Fiction. So I was listening to an interview, he'd been in Westworld with Anthony Hopkins, and he was recounting a story that he'd heard from Anthony Hopkins, who in his younger days, when he was known to be a bit of a rogue and had his issues with alcohol, was also in that kind of golden era of British thespians. He'd lost out on a role to Christopher Plummer because of his behaviour, and had then gone to see Christopher Plummer play in that role, and then went backstage and gave him both barrels about how he would have done it better. And then 45 years, I think it was like 45 years later, bumped into Christopher Plummer at some function and said, I'm really sorry about that. And Christopher Plummer was like, well, I don't even remember that at all. But he'd held on to this. And then he's obviously a really big... He's really big in the Alcoholics Anonymous thing, and really helping with campaigning on that front. So I think for that, a negative moment can be really helpful if you take it and help to better yourself and others.
Because you must have found when you're doing KMTV, live or otherwise, sometimes you might be thinking, I wish I hadn't said that, or this is awful. But actually, it's the best thing that could have happened, because it has given you the ability to, you know, think on your feet or to know how to cope in difficult situations.
Yeah, I think it's more the resilience. It's just like, nobody got hurt. Accidents happen. It's just, mistakes happen. It's learning from them. And it's trying not to get wrapped up and dwell on it. I think everybody, that Anthony Hopkins story tells all that everybody is going to dwell on stuff. For even if it was so minuscule, someone will dwell on it for ages. You know, I dwell on things that I've said to people or ways that I approach a situation. But I just try and not do that again. Or if it was really quite true, like I said, if I messed up alive, not to let it get me down, because either I won't do it again, or it really, in the grand scheme of things, it hasn't hurt anyone. It hasn't created a big old issue. So
It made me think of something. I remember feeling like something awful had happened. I was doing live radio, and suddenly this other voice came through, and it was the weather that was on the system, because if the show isn't live, you have a pre-recorded weather package. And I was already starting my show, and suddenly there were these two voices, me doing the weather and suddenly this automated voice. And I remember thinking, oh, it's completely ruined my show. But actually, the whole show, I kept referring to this and making jokes about it. And I actually thought, well, actually, it gave me a line. Yeah. It always gave me something to work with.
It gave you a hook.
And that really surprised me. But often those things that you know, people like it when things go a little bit wrong, but it shows that we're human.
It's authentic. And I quite often think with that sort of thing, I absolutely love talk shows, and it's obviously a huge thing in America as well. And you know, they're not like here. Well, they'll have Jonathan Ross or Graham Norton will do one a week. They'll do five. You know, it's almost like Broadway.
Like Jay Leno
or like, you know, Conan O'Brien and Seth Meyers and Jimmy Kimmel. Again, coming back to him, all of them, like each a person, are like, if you've had a bad night, you don't have the time to think about it being a bad night, because you've got to do it exactly the same the next night. And it's that sort of, it's just keeping going.
I used to find that if I'm teaching and I'm standing in front of an audience, if I say something wrong, I've got plenty of opportunities to pick myself up. So it's I'm not too stressed about it. If I'm in the audience and I'm asking a question, that's my moment. And I might have 10, 15 seconds. And it may well be that if I lose my way, other people around me will say, oh, you know, enough of him, it's my turn. So in other words, I'm just a small peg in a wheel. But if I'm presenting the thing and I don't like how I say it, I can frame the narrative. And I feel the same way about doing TV. You know, it's easier sometimes to be the presenter than it is to be the guest.
But I think it's important to have that feeling of not wanting to screw up, because that shows you really care about what you're doing, and B, it means that you'll do everything you can to avoid making mistakes, or thinking, how can I make this the best it possibly can be?
I've actually learned, because I do 3 minutes every Thursday on KMTV, and I always watch myself back, and I always put it out there on YouTube, etc. And I do that for a reason, because it's sometimes I think it's better than maybe a previous week. Sometimes I often think it's worse than a previous week. But it's important to watch and learn from that.
Yes.
You know, I didn't realise when I started that I moved my hands around quite as much as I do. And I've managed to find strategies of keeping that at bay. And also making sure that I don't do the sort of, not just the ums and ahs, but I do it on the radio as well, the yeah, or the sort of, you know, saying things that are fine once in a while, but sometimes can get a bit annoying. And you're not aware of them unless you sort of watch yourself back. And so sometimes you need to go through that in order to become a better presenter. But it has to be a threshold that you have to be good enough. But you're building on that threshold.
But you have to be true and authentic to the reason that you got there in the first place.
Yeah.
Like what you were saying a moment ago, like that is the reason you're there is you. So yes, fine tune the things that might annoy you or might annoy viewers, but don't lose the essence.
That's true. And I've actually found that I enjoy that, sort of channeling that. It can be an eccentricity or it can be a particular trait. And they're the people you remember growing up. It would have been well before your time, but you would have heard the names of the sort of Magnus Pike or the Barbara Woodhouse or the David Bellamy or the Johnny Bull. And they would have been, you know, TV presenters who we enjoyed watching, because they seem very, very strange, very, you know, they seem so much older and they're very eccentric, but we admired them because they had a real passion which was communicated through the style, which nobody else had. And yet they're the ones that we remember. So we may have laughed at them sometimes for being a bit eccentric, but they're the ones who've stayed with us all these decades later.
Yeah, and I think that's still the case. That is why you have TV personalities. It's personality. It's in the name. So You know, I can't put myself in that bracket, you know, of course, but I know what a viewer's going to enjoy, or even if it's something that I don't particularly enjoy watching, I can still appreciate how you would get an audience, or how one would get an audience with a particular, you know, particular mannerisms, particular catchphrases. You know, there is always a method to the madness.
Yeah, and I have to ask you one last question. This is the question I always finish my interviews with, which is whether you consider yourself, Cameron, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Ooh. Can you say 50-50?
Yeah, well, many people have said, I don't believe in binaries. What a silly question. And then started talking about things like Brexit, you know?
Yeah. I think I am a forward... I definitely... this is really throwing me a tizz on that one. I find I spend lots of time thinking about what I'd like to do with... you know, family and friends, places I want to go, things I want to do, achievements I want to, accomplishments I want to achieve. But I also spend probably an equal amount of time thinking about what I've done with those people or myself that I've enjoyed and how I want to recapture that experience and have those new experiences, if that makes sense.
It does. The two are, I do think they're different sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're the same side of the same coin in some respects.
Yeah. Well, lots of coins.
Yeah.
To, you know, for each... using another film reference, it's like Inside Out, and the memory balls that they have is that there's not... You know, there's very rarely going to be one colour for each experience. It's going to be different shades. And... for me, that's how I definitely... That film explained a lot. But that it definitely helps that that's how I see a lot of experiences I have and my kind of outlook of... I call it bucket list syndrome. I have so many things that I've got written out, that places I want to go, things I want to do. And I'm, you know, I'm almost obsessing at times about, like, right, I'm, you know, I need to find the time to do... to do these things, dwelling on what I've done in the past to help me, you know, make that bucket list ticked off.
Absolutely, and also that no one says it has to be linear. You can tick it off. You can go back over the list. You can do it in the wrong order. You can maybe add to it or take things off the list.
Tweak it.
Well, what an amazing chat. Thank you, Cameron. For being at last, you finally did it.
I'm so glad I did. Thank you so much, Chris, for having me and for being so patient to get to this stage. But it's been a real pleasure. It's been really, really nice to reflect and look forward.